First, may I express my thanks to Bill Trotter for his gracious introduction. He's a generous and kindly and good friend. And it's always good to have a friend introduce you, because they never let truth stand in the way of a good introduction. And I'm so pleased for the privilege that you've afforded me today of being here in Macon, Georgia, to talk with you. I want to especially pay my respects to the Association of County Commissioners and to the Municipal Association, Mr. Carmichael and Mr. LeRoy. I have worked with these gentlemen and their associations, the National Association of County Officials, the League of Cities, the U.S. Conference of Mayors. This has been part of my public life. And during my opportunity to serve as Vice President, I was directed by President Johnson to be the liaison officer, the contact between these municipal and county and local government organizations and the White House and the federal government. During that period of time, I think I profited the most. I learned a great deal. At the same time, tried to be a helping hand to get some things done. But I'm particularly honored today to be in the state of Georgia that has given to this nation such great sons, great leadership. Just as we were coming into your city, I was reminded of the Walter George School of Law. I was reminded of a great Secretary of State, Dean Rusk, who was so proud of his Georgia heritage. I had the privilege of serving for 16 years and 4 years as Vice President with a wonderful United States Senator, Senator Russell, a great patriot, and a man that sorely missed. And now I serve under the chairmanship of and as an associate of the distinguished senior senator of the state of Georgia, Herman Talmadge. And to have him invite me to this occasion to permit me to see, to be with his people and the people of this state is a rare honor. And I want to thank him. I can say to you most candidly that the subject matter that we're discussing today would most likely not even be within the purview of the Congress of the United States or being given the attention that it is now receiving in Washington were it not for Senator Herman Talmadge. In fact, there would be no law requiring the highest priority to be given to the revitalization and the development of rural areas of America. No commitment to a national policy establishing a sound balance between rural and urban America. And had it not have been for the leadership of your distinguished senior senator that's to my left and your right, there'd be no committee in the United States Senate that would be devoting much of its attention, indeed the major portion of its attention, to rural development. Now, when I say rural development, I'm not just talking about a farm out at Waverly, Minnesota, where I live, a community of 312 people. I'm not talking about my neighbor across the little township road alone. I'm talking about the vast areas of America that are not known as the metropolitan areas. Maybe we define rural areas best by saying what it is not. I'm talking about communities of 10,000, 15, 25, yes, up to 50,000. And the trade territory that surrounds them. I'm a son of the soil, and my parents and my grandparents before me. My grandfather, my mother's side, a Norwegian immigrant that came to America and took out a homestead in South Dakota. My father's parents, farmers in Elk River, Minnesota, and first of all in Connecticut, my great-grandfather. I grew up in a little town in South Dakota. We still have our home drugstore, our pharmacy, and that pharmacy is directly related, its success is directly related to the people that come to our door. My father reminded me at a very early age in life that we were no more prosperous and no better off than the people that came to patronize us and the territory in which we lived. So I come to this subject of local government as a mayor of a city that had a unique combination of both some metropolitan features as well as small town features. I come to this subject as the son of a man who was a mayor of two communities and an alderman and a state legislator in a rural community out in South Dakota. And there later on, I went on into Minnesota. I think that there is, at least from experience and from life itself, some understanding of what we face here in this great land of ours today in terms of public problems of population and the use of our resources. And I want to concentrate today a little bit on some of my views and some of the things that we might be able to do. Senator Talmadge has given me a rare opportunity that I intend to utilize to help this country. And that is, he has permitted me by his appointment to serve as chairman of a Senate subcommittee on rural development. And we have seized this opportunity because it's something, as was said here, its time has come. And by the way, Mr. Fannin, I've heard of your good work and the wonderful leadership that you have given here in Georgia. And I'm well aware of the many programs of county cooperation in Georgia, of county government cooperation in planning and the utilization of resources. And may I say that the structure known as county government is coming into its own, because it is a structure big enough in terms of authority and jurisdiction to meet some of the problems that we face today. But it is going to be necessary for municipalities and county governments to coordinate their services, and it's going to be necessary for other states in the union to take a look at what you're doing here, and you to take a look at what some of them are doing, as to how we pool, how we bring together vital services for the people on an efficient basis with some relationship of service to cost. In other words, we're at a point now where we're really almost writing a whole new constitution for local government, because local government is vital to our federal system. We cannot operate out of Washington. You and I know that. We don't need to make any long dissertation on it. This is a vast country with many peoples, many geographical differences, many cultural differences, many climatic differences. I left Minneapolis this morning. I was with the business people of my city and the city of St. Paul this morning on the National Alliance of Businessmen, working on what we call a jobs program for our unemployed, and particularly for our deprived and poor young people. I've been involved in this program since my days as vice president. It was raining in Minneapolis last night, and this morning it was rather chilly, even though spring has come to us. And I flew here in rapid transportation that just tells you in how we move in this country. In less than 2.5 hours, I left from Minneapolis out here to your airport. From one section of the country that we call the North and the upper Midwest into the deep South. And you know something? You look just exactly like the folks I just left. And they look very much like you. And I wouldn't be a bit surprised but what our problems are almost identical. In fact, our twins aren't winning many ball games, neither are the Braves. So we're both in trouble. Well, you might say, is there any basic authority for the legislative authority for what we're seeking to do here now as we talk about rural community development? Yes, the man here, your senator, placed in the law of the land in the last Agricultural Act of the Congress, the preceding Congress, what is known as Title IX. It was introduced and pushed through by Senator Talmadge, and by the way, my associate from Minnesota, Senator Mondale, was very helpful in it. In addition to establishing a national commitment to a sound balance between rural and urban America, it also requires that the federal administration, the president, and his agents, the Secretary of Agriculture and others, send to the Congress information each year on federal programs and services to the people of rural America. And we're going to get 5 of those reports this year, and you can rest assured we're going to examine them, because we want to see what's being done, and not only what's being done, but how it's being done. I think it's necessary, therefore, for us to pick up the question that Mr. Fannin placed before us. Where is this country headed? And he told you some population figures. Well, let me just add to them. Our population since World War II has grown by 55 million. That's more people than are in Great Britain or France. That's just the add-on that we've had since World War II. The value of goods and services has grown from $280 billion at the end of World War II to nearly $1 trillion in 1971. Fantastic economic growth. Why, the two-home family in many parts of this country is becoming nearly as commonplace as the two-car family, and many families more than cars than that. And it sounds pretty good, doesn't it? But wait, there's a little bit more. Something else has happened. 3 million farms have disappeared from the face of this land of ours through the technological revolution that's sweeping agriculture. And only 1 in 5 of our farm boys can remain on the farm. 1 in 5. No jobs. No place for them. If you have 5 sons, mother, on the farm, only 1 can find a place in rural America. Now that's a statistical fact. More than 20 million people have literally abandoned the small farms and towns for the big cities, thinking it was going to be better. So that today we find 75% of our people crowded on less than 2% of our land, and 25% of our people on 98% of our land. There's a vast hinterland in this country, undeveloped, and in every state we find the same thing. The result of all this has been a national crisis of population and environment. We call this environmental crisis, ecology. That's what the talk is all about. And it is serious, and it's going to get more serious, because as people bunch together in smaller areas, they create immense, not only human problems, but physical problems and legal problems. And all of this problem of changing relationships between the people and the land has festered the social and economic sores which have erupted amongst us. If the trend continues, in the next 30 years, 100 million more Americans, as has been said, will be crammed into the big cities where 150 million are already living. To look at it another way, if these 100 million new Americans were to live in newly created communities, get this now, if these new 100, and that's what we're going to have, 100 million between 1970 and the year 2000, according to all estimates and projections, if they were to live in newly created communities, a city the size of Portland, Oregon, would have to be created every 40 days over the next 30 years. I was just out in Portland, Oregon not long ago, and that takes quite a lot of doing to build a city like Portland, Oregon. And imagine having to do it every 40 days. Is it any wonder that we're a troubled nation? We're vaguely aware that we might have been able to stop this had we done some advanced planning. Instead, we rushed after something that we call progress. I guess we've made a good deal of it, piling more and more people into less and less space. I, for one, think that these trends can be stopped, or at least slowed down, or possibly reversed. Certainly, a nation which has explored outer space and seems to be interested in the surface of the moon, and we've been exploring it for a decade, ought to be able to muster the energy, the know-how, the technology, and the will to create a better life here in our own country that offers opportunity and decent living conditions for all. But ladies and gentlemen, that I was chairman of the Space Council for 4 years, and we knew what we were doing. We had a plan, we made the commitment, people understood it, the Congress understood it, we knew how much money it was going to cost. We said that we'd do it within a decade, put a man on the moon, and we charted our course. And it was done. Has anybody had a plan? Has anybody even thought about even discussing a plan or a concept? Not something that you force on people, but just to think about it as to what we were going to do in terms of a national growth policy, where people were going to live? I don't think so. The fact is that we've done all too little or nothing about it. We must understand that land as space to live on is taking priority of the old concept of land as something to be exploited. So we have to head towards what I call an urban-rural balance, a healthy balance between the people and the land. The fact is that we have space to spare. This country is loaded with plenty of space. And with modern means of transportation, why everybody gang up and get to such close little areas? You know, not long ago I read, and it's documented, that if the same density of population that now exists in Harlem, New York, were applied to the other four boroughs of New York City, the other four sections of New York City, you would be able to put in the other four boroughs all 200 million Americans. Is it any wonder that there's violence? Is there any wonder that there are social conditions almost beyond human, beyond human comprehension? When you have people piled on top of each other, literally, it is bound to be explosive and unhealthy. I remember in the presidential campaign, speaking before an apartment house in Brooklyn, and I saw such a big crowd outside. Of course, I was very pleased to see a big crowd. I didn't get them every place I went, as you may recall. And I said to my sponsor there, the organizer, the chairman, I said, listen, there surely is a big crowd here, but I said, where do they all come from? He said, that apartment house. And I said, how many people are in that apartment house? He said, 22,000. Well, I said, that's more people as in Beadle County, South Dakota. He said, well, Mr. Vice President, he said, we have lots of apartment houses like that. But those apartment houses didn't have the same number of police officers that we had in Beadle County, South Dakota, or in Wright County, Minnesota, where I live. They didn't have the land, the flowers, the trees. Listen, you can't keep people living in concrete and mortar and steel and locked up in brick without making them animals. God Almighty put trees and shrubs and flowers and bushes and streams and brooks and land to humanize this thing called man. And we've determined to do something. We've determined to try to turn it around. That somehow or another, all we thought was just have massive plateaus of concrete and asphalt, pile people into what we call the great city, and everything would be better. Well, now, don't misunderstand me. The city ought to be the finest place in the world to live, and it can be, if we understand what its purpose is. That city should have parks, forests, lakes, playgrounds, open space. And if it doesn't have it, then we have to find places where those things do exist. Why is it that we insist on having national forests 400 miles away from the people? Europeans learned a long time ago that you can have a forest right inside of Paris. London is a great city. There are five times as many acres of parkland in London as there is in Chicago and New York combined. Maybe that's why their crime rate isn't so much. It could be. Well, we have lots of space and we haven't done much with it. I'm saying that we need a national growth policy. And that central premise of that policy has to be the relationship of people to land, water, air, and resources. Now, I'm sure you folks here are wondering what I have in mind. What is this fellow Humphrey going to do to lick this problem that's been outlined here, this of rural out-migration? What are we going to do to strike a better balance between big cities and rural America? Well, I'll tell you one thing, quickly. I don't have all the answers. Because if I did, I'd be too busy to be here. That's why we're going to, at the direction of Senator Talmadge and the government, conduct an extensive investigation, just what the problems are and what the needs are. And we intend to find some answers. And the more we look at rural community development, the more I'm convinced that most of the experts thus far are only experts in making generalizations. We've got to go out and get some hard facts. And then develop a legislative program. And to recognize that legislation is only a small part of it. We ought to have at least three objectives. First, get the facts. And we'll do that. Secondly, we must publicize the plight of rural America and the promise. The promise. Don't publicize just its bad features, but the promise. Unfortunately, the deterioration that takes place in our countryside doesn't get as much attention as an explosion or a riot or violence or a breakdown of services in a major metropolitan area. And finally, we'll try to develop, as I said, a comprehensive set of recommendations to see if we can't do something to deal with the depressed economic conditions of our rural areas. Let me just cite quickly that when you read about poverty, ladies and gentlemen, I think there are certain things we ought to know. There are more poor whites than there are poor blacks. That's number one. Number two, there are more poor people in rural America than there are in urban America. The trouble is that we don't seem to get the same amount of attention to these problems out in the rural areas because they're spread out. The worst housing in America is not to be found in the slums of our great cities, but in the slums of the hills and valleys of parts of rural America. And maybe this tells us one of the reasons why we're having more problems. Now, to meet this national problem head on, I submit that we've got to declare a new freedom in this country, a freedom of residence. We must establish the right of all of our people to have a realistic choice about where they're going to live and work, not a choice that's dictated by politics or economics. This means that young people will not be forced, as they are now, to migrate to large and turbulent metropolitan areas just because there are no jobs at home. They may want to go to the great city. Many of them will, and they ought to surely have that right and that privilege. But they ought to have a real choice. And not the choice between no jobs and maybe a job. Not the choice between no schools or poor schools and possibly fairly good schools. But an equal choice. This means then that people who may want to live in small town areas, ladies and gentlemen, can expect to find good schools for their children, decent transportation system, the best of medical care and medical facilities. We can't just go around and sell fresh air, you know, and lots of place to stretch. That isn't enough. Modern America, younger America, wants some action. And these young men and women that we're educating in our schools, when they come out, they want good schools for their children. They want a doctor. And there's a doctor shortage all over rural America. I met yesterday noon for 2 hours in a question and answer and symposium with the Minnesota Pharmaceutical Association. I'm originally trained as a pharmacist. Talking about the medical problems, the health problems of this country, meeting with the doctors. We're short 50,000 of them, and most of them in rural areas. Now, if you want to develop a national growth policy, you're going to have doctors and schools and transportation and roads and cultural and recreational activities, just like you can get them in the cities. People do not go to the cities just because they don't know what to do. They go there because they may think they have a better chance. I happen to believe that America's rural new policy must mean new industries and modern social services and cultural activities. And it must mean that Americans should be able to enjoy all the benefits of life, liberty, and property, not only in big cities, not only in suburbs, but all over America. Now, you know, a century ago, there was a fellow by the name of Horace Greeley that used to say, "Go west, young man." Now, that wasn't a tourist slogan. There were no tourist agencies at that time. It was a firm national population policy designed to help America's best interests. My grandfather came to the United States under a firm population policy of this country, the Homestead Act. They didn't just say, "Come out and breathe the fresh air in Minnesota and South Dakota." They said, "Mr. Sanis, come on out here, and if you do come far enough, if you'll just go beyond New York and Pittsburgh, we'll get you a piece of land, 160 acres, and you can start a farm and live." And it was an inducement. You see, what I'm saying is the federal government had a program once. It had incentives, the Homestead Act. It had incentives to the railroads, too. Oh, I know a few of those railroad barons became millionaires, but I'll tell you something else. Maybe some of them didn't deserve it. But they did provide highways of steel to bring in people and to bring in the crops. But they didn't get it by just saying, "Would you like some fresh air and listen to the birds?" They said, "We'll give you 6 miles on each side of the track. Go to it." And they built railroads, a policy. Just a little over 100 years ago, the federal government encouraged the growth of higher education, land-grant colleges, the Morrill Act, 1862, or there wouldn't have been any higher education out in the Great Plains. But the government said, "We're going to do something about it," and some of the great universities are in the land-grant colleges. In 1896, the federal government acted to establish a rural free delivery. Why? Because if you were going to move, you had to be able to be in communication. How were you going to get your Sears and Roebuck catalog? How were you going to get the crop reports? And then somehow or another, we stopped as farming became more mechanized. And Americans just tumbled into the cities like a hemorrhage from rural America. So we now have seen the effects of a non-policy, a no-policy population policy. Now we're supposed to be trained in politics to find answers to problems and not merely cite the problems. And we can. I think we have to develop then that long-range population policy to bring vitality back to rural America. Yes, the fifth freedom, which I believe that my son is entitled to and my grandchildren. Freedom of residence, a real choice, and not to be forced to move because of politics or economics. Well, friends, when we talk about urban and rural problems, we really get into what you might call the great unknowns. And that's why we're going out to talk to farmers and rural businessmen and the teachers and the preacher, the young and the not so young, as we try to develop a program. Already at the instruction of Senator Talmadge and our staff, we're writing to every governor in the United States. We're writing to every senator, asking them to tell us what's going on in your state. What are you doing at the state level today to promote a population policy that is for the dispersal of people, the freedom of choice of residents? What are you doing to build industry to encourage economic growth? And I believe that getting this basic information plus some of our trips across this country, we'll maybe find out some things that were quite evident. I believe that we will find that rural Americans are often discriminated against in many different ways. Now, we've had a lot of talk about racial discrimination, and we're doing something about it. But what about economic discrimination? I happen to believe that economic discrimination today ties in very directly to every form of discrimination. For example, rural people are less likely than their city cousins to have the opportunity for quality education. Now, that's a fact under every study. They don't have the same health and dental facilities, and they desperately need them. I saw a dental report not long ago about the care of teeth of children in rural America. I'm not talking just about farm kids now. I'm talking about people in smaller towns. And they say that the condition is about 200% worse for the youngsters in rural America than it is in urban America. And why? Shortage of dentists and clinics. It's difficult to find jobs, at least well-paid jobs, in some of our rural areas. Our country cousins often don't have access to real job training, and many times not to unemployment compensation. Public transportation in rural America needs expansion and modernization. We still haven't done the job of getting water and sewer facilities into the country. Not to mention things like fire protection and sufficient decent housing, libraries, hospitals, and medical services. Let me give you a little example of what I'm talking about. I pay on my little home in Waverly, Minnesota, in the country, exactly 10 times more fire insurance premium than I pay in Washington, D.C., on a home that is worth twice as much. And the reason is there's no fire department around. You know, I mean, that they call a fire department. No facilities. Now, that's economic discrimination, not something I can't personally bear. The Lord has been good to me, and the country has, but it hurts some people. We still haven't gotten the job done of getting water and sewer facilities, as I said. Only when the nation is aware, therefore, of these discriminations will we get something done. And we're going to go out and we're going to blow the bugle. We're going to announce to the public that something is underway, and I think the time is ripe for it. I think when people begin to sense their sickness, they then start the healing process. I think when they begin to sense the dimension of the problem, then they start to design the dimension of the answer. Instead of a little patch here and a little patch there, I've sold a lot of Band-Aids in my life. In fact, they're a good profit item in any drugstore. But I'm here to tell you that no matter how many Band-Aids you put on, if you've got serious infection and open running sores, it'll never do the job. Now, we've put together a number of programs in Congress. Rural housing, for example. The Department of Housing and Urban Development has been doing a little bit about it, but not much. I believe I could say to a county commissioner that you have a pretty tough time sometimes getting much action out of the Department of Housing and Urban Development because you're not sufficiently urbanized. Now you say, well, that's not so bad because after all, we still have the Farmers Home Administration. But then he looked to find out about the Farmers Home Administration, and the administration tried to cut its funds $500 million just this last year. Money that had been appropriated by members of the Congress. But fortunately, the White House heard an uproar from thousands of protesting people from the counties and the rural communities, and the funds were restored. But the present administration has simply refused to spend or invest, I prefer to call it, $1 billion of money which the Congress has appropriated to help rural America. Now, I'm not going to be very impressed with a lot of speeches in high places about what we need to do to make America more beautiful when there's $1 billion worth of funds tied up that the duly elected representatives of the people have appropriated for constructive purposes under law that's been passed by both Republican and Democratic administrations. I, for the life of me, can't understand what makes July 1st so much more important than June 30th. Starting July 1st, we're supposed to have a full employment budget. And we're going to spend and spend. Franklin Roosevelt will wonder what are